Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, I-17 southbound, a crash at Union Hills has the right lanes blocked. And on the 202 eastbound Santan Freeway, a crash blocks the Gilbert Road on-ramp. Look for partly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 98 degrees, 20% chance of rain this afternoon. Same goes for tonight. Look for partly cloudy skies, overnight lows in the upper 70s. It's 95 degrees right now.
Arizona's 1st Congressional District is one of the largest districts in the country. It spans from Lake Powell down to just north of Tucson, wrapping around Phoenix. From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
The district includes retirees, college students, minors, veterans, and more Native Americans than any other district in the state. Northern Arizona University Politics and International Affairs Professor Fred Solop says the candidates have their work cut out for them.
You can't choose one population to focus on it. It really is a diverse district, and it was established by the Redistricting Commission as a competitive district. So the balance between Democrat and Republican is very close. There's a slight edge to Democrats in the district, but Republicans have held the seat as well.
Both Democratic candidates facing off in the primary are new to the party. Former Republican and Independent Tom O'Halloran was a fixture at the state legislature. He's raised the most money out of all of the candidates. Five Republicans will be on the ballot. Solop says the standouts are former Secretary of State Ken Bennett and tough on immigration Sheriff Paul Babiou. Former Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick left this seat to challenge John McCain in the U.S. Senate race. An open congressional seat is rare.
That means that it's become a focus of the National Democrats and the National Republicans. They really want to win this seat. So a lot of money is going to be coming into this district once we're past the primary phase.
So leading up to the general election, Solop says the district will be inundated with National Party-funded TV and radio ads. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
And in another congressional race in Arizona, Congressman Matt Salmon announced earlier this year he would not seek re-election as the 5th congressional district representative. From KJZZ's East Valley Bureau, Jimmy Jenkins reports his departure has led to 4 Republicans squaring off in next week's primary.
Upon announcing he would not seek re-election, Representative Salmon endorsed Senate President Andy Biggs to succeed him in the seat. Former Maricopa County Supervisor Don Stapley, State Representative Justin Olson, and former GoDaddy executive Christine Jones joined Biggs on the Republican ballot. The 5th District includes parts of Mesa, Gilbert, and Chandler and extends east to Apache Junction. Stapley says his number one priority as congressman would be reducing corporate taxes to encourage more development in the United States.
If they could just bring back their corporate profits that they make overseas, they would be building more high-tech manufacturing plants here instead of in Israel or in Ireland or in China.
Stapley touts his experience passing balanced budgets during his time as a county supervisor and his ability to be a coalition builder as his best qualifications.
There are lots of good people in the Democratic Party who, with the right approach and good, strong persuasion, can be brought to consensus and can actually get things done.
State Representative Olson echoed Stapley's call for fiscal conservatism at the national level.
My number one priority is to make sure that we balance our budget, that we lower the debt, that we keep our tax burden low, that we grow the economy and have a strong and bright future for our children and their kids.
Christine Jones is presenting herself as an outsider. She is the only candidate in the race who has never held elected office. She says her background in technology would help guide her attempts to strengthen national security.
We have to have a stable and secure infrastructure, and we have to have laws that make there a consequence when you violate it.
Her opponents have criticized Jones for actually being an outsider. She does not live in the 5th District, but Jones contends her conservative values are consistent with the voters of the East Valley. Andy Biggs is also running for the congressional seat. In a statement, his campaign manager said of Biggs, quote, "This is not a job that he wants, and he's not in this to climb the ladder, but he feels compelled to serve." The Democratic ballot in this primary features 2 candidates, Talia Fuentes and Kenzie Remaklis. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Trouble could be on the horizon for a controversial Phoenix nonprofit. In recent months, Advocates for Individuals with Disabilities, or AID, has filed hundreds of lawsuits against local businesses for violating the Americans with Disabilities Act. The organization's aggressive tactics have angered many in the business community, and this week, Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich came to their aid. He's intervened in the cases, asking they be dismissed. KJZZ's Will Stone has been reporting on this issue, and he joins me. So, Will, is it unusual for the AG to take this kind of action?
It is, Mark, and especially because the AG has not just intervened, but he's intervened on behalf of the defense, that is, the businesses that are being sued and have allegedly violated the law. But it appears he has serious concerns about what this group has been doing. They've been filing upwards of, they say, 2,000 lawsuits for ADA violations, or we should say alleged ADA violations, most of which are for what you might call kind of minor violations. These often have to do with parking lot issues, and they're based on some new rules that were implemented by the Department of Justice in 2010, the height of a sign or the width of a van accessible space, among other things. And this group has essentially been going from zip code to zip code, filing these suits against every business with a perceived violation. And all these complaints generally demand the same thing. They say you have to fix the problem and pay anywhere from $5,000 to $7,500 in attorney's fees, and most businesses, rather than spend that amount on a lawyer, decide to just settle and get it over with.
So what exactly is the Attorney General saying here then?
There are a host of allegations, Mark, but the main one is that the group has essentially circumvented the Attorney General's authority in enforcing the Americans with Disabilities Act. There's an Arizona version of the law as well as the federal version. And the Attorney General says there are proper channels for resolving these issues and that really the Attorney General should be handling this and trying to facilitate some kind of resolution that doesn't necessarily mean a lawsuit. And that goes on to say that the plaintiffs are essentially serial litigators and they're engaging in, quote, trolling tactics that are meant to coerce defendants to settle quickly and for their own enrichment, essentially. So it's important to note that damages are not awardable under the federal version of the ADA, but the lawyers' fees are essentially where the money is coming from in these settlements.
So what does AID say in response to this?
The organization is defending its practices, same as it always has. And there are a couple points here. The first is AID is a nonprofit. It was recently formed at the beginning of this year. They say all the settlement money goes to helping people with disabilities by providing them with gifts like wheelchairs, for example. And the attorney who's filed all these is a man named Peter Stroynick. He says he makes no money off of this at all and that they're fighting for civil rights. And the fact of the matter is most businesses are not entirely compliant. They may, you know, especially with these parking lot violations. So I caught up with Stroynick yesterday, and this is what he had to say about the Attorney General's action.
It is not political. The Attorney General has to take a side. Does he side with the disability community and with the civil rights attorneys, or does he side with the law-breaking defendant? I believe that he has decided to side with the law-breaking defendant. That is despicable.
And I will tell you, I've talked to others in the disabilities community who may be ambivalent about AID's tactics and how aggressive they've been, but they're also concerned that the Attorney General has sided with the defense, the people who have allegedly broken the law.
So what's next here, then?
AID has to respond. They have until the beginning, early next month to do so. They have some other issues, too. They've been hammered in the press recently, and their executive director this week, a woman named Jennifer Rogers, resigned. So we'll just see how this all shakes out. But from speaking with Peter Stroynick, it seems they have no intention of slowing down.
That's KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thanks.
My pleasure, Mark.
Almost a third of high school senior student athletes in Arizona report having had a concussion. That's one of the findings of a web survey compiled by Barrow Neurological Institute. The results are from 304 males and females between 14 and 18 years old, and also show 1 in 4 boys decided not to play high school football, and 1 in 10 girls decided not to play high school soccer because they were worried about concussions. Dr. Javier Cardenas is the director of the Barrow Concussion and Brain Injury Center at Barrow Neurological Institute. And Javier, when a third of seniors who play high school sports report having a concussion, how confident are you in that number?
Well, indeed, every year we do a survey of some sort in order to really put our hands on the pulse of Arizona citizens as it pertains to concussion. And this year we went to the heart of the issue. We went straight to the youth, the adolescent athletes. And what we found is of those who we surveyed between 14 and 18 years of age, those who were in 12th grade, the oldest, 30% of them reported having a concussion at some point during their high school career. Now, this is far greater than what we see in the literature, far greater than what we report nationally in terms of the incidence about concussion, which is usually about 10%. In terms of the accuracy, we are not quite sure what it actually may reflect.
Relative to those other states, you mentioned Arizona's numbers are a bit higher. Do you chalk that up to students here better being able to recognize the symptoms, or do you think that student-athletes here get more concussions for some reason?
Well, interestingly enough, if you compared those older students versus the younger ones, those who are freshmen and sophomores in high school, they actually reported 10% of them having a concussion. And so that may be a reflection of their current understanding as they are beginning the process of education versus a change in the incidence.
When you look at the results of this survey as a whole, you know, there are numbers that indicate there are students who have decided not to go into certain sports because of a fear of concussions. 42% of athletes who have had one say they're not afraid of the long-term impact of having one or having multiple concussions. What do you take away from the results when you look at them as a whole?
When we look at them as a whole, what we're really trying to do is to make sure that every single sport, regardless of what kids want to play, is as safe as possible. Because at the end of the day, it is the decision of the parents, it's the decision of the child to participate. And so we want to see where do they see the risks? How can we impact safety and health in those sports so that when they make these decisions, they have a good understanding of what the outcome may be as it results, as it pertains to their injury.
Does it concern you that given the requirement that all student athletes go through the education program that you have helped put forward, that only 75% of student athletes said they'd received concussion education?
Absolutely. It definitely concerns us that up to a quarter of them reported not having received any concussion education. Now, in the state of Arizona, every single high school athlete that participates in AIA sports must complete the education. So this gap in the survey may represent those who are non-athletes as well as those who play club sports and are not required to have concussion education. Our intention then is to broaden our reach for concussion education beyond the high school athlete so that we can make sure they are informed.
Dr. Javier Cardenas is the director of the Barrow Concussion and Brain Injury Center at Barrow Neurological Institute. We are talking about a new web survey of high school student athletes.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Phil Latzman.
And Steve, we are wrapping up a week of primary previews that you've heard here on KJZZ. And earlier this month, Senator John McCain visited our studios to answer your questions and mine as he seeks a fifth term in office.
We offered the same invitation to his main challenger for the GOP nomination, former state Senator Kelly Ward, who visited this week.
And the 47-year-old osteopathic physician was elected twice to the state Senate from Lake Havasu City before she stepped down last year to focus on, as she puts it, giving John McCain the gift of retirement as he celebrates his 80th birthday on Monday. We'll have more on that in a moment. But first, we began by discussing why a successful doctor wanted to get into the sometimes unhealthy world of politics.
You know, I never thought that I would run for office, really. I had been active. My husband and I actually met because we were both active in medical student politics within the medical profession. And so we were kind of activists for our career and for the people that we served and for our patients. But Obamacare was the thing that pushed me over the edge to actually run for office because Arizona was contemplating Medicaid expansion, which is part of Obamacare, and Obamacare state-based exchanges. And there were no conservative voices for healthcare in the state legislature at all. There were two very liberal doctors who were in the House side. And so I ran for the Senate, and somehow I was able to be victorious. Everyone told me I was going to lose, I'll tell you, even my consultants. But I was able to win and win resoundingly. nationally. And then I ran again for my second term. No one ran against me. And so I think that the people were happy with what I delivered. But really, health care was the reason that I actually got into politics.
So speaking of Obamacare, if you are elected to the Senate, is that something that is number one on your list to try to get Obamacare repealed?
Well, of course, I like to say when I'm elected. But yes, it is definitely something that is important to me. The first policy proposal that I made during this campaign swing this year is the Patient Power Plan, which is a full repeal of Obamacare, including all the taxes and the regulations that go along with it. That's going to save our country billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars. And more importantly, my plan puts the power of health care back where it belongs. It takes it away from insurance company executives and politicians and bureaucrats and puts it into the hands of patients so that we get the health care that we want and need rather than waiting for the government to see what they're going to provide for us.
In the year since you announced this challenge to Senator McCain, have you exceeded your own expectations for this campaign?
You know, it has been amazing. Really, I have met so many people all over the entire state, and the outcry is that they want to change Washington, D.C. And we all know we cannot change Washington unless we change the people we send there. Senator McCain's been there for almost 40 years. And so when he, at this point, when he's going for his sixth term, he's been in the Senate 30 years, and he's telling us, I'm going to finally secure the border now. I'm going to finally fix the VA now. I'm going to finally take care of our economic problems. No one believes him.
You've been out-fundraised something like 7-1. How do you keep up financially with the McCain machine?
You know, we have been very, very successful in our fundraising and actually have raised more than any insurgent candidate really across the whole country in any race, House or Senate. So it has been amazing what we've been able to accomplish, over $1.5 million, which I never thought I would ever say I had raised. And so we've been able to use that money wisely.
Speaking of that, you know, you mentioned the fundraising issues and the super PACs, and Carl on Twitter asks this: why does she welcome New York funded super PACs after consistently deriding out of state funded super PACs? And he's referring to Robert Mercer, who's a huge GOP donor and a hedge fund billionaire who supports Donald Trump and also gave $200,000 to your campaign recently.
Yeah, I haven't been deriding the super PAC process itself. I've been deriding what the Arizona Grassroots Action PAC has been willing to say. Total lies. You know, Senator McCain, his MO has been for years to lie, scare people, and spend a lot of money to hope that he stays in Washington. And the Arizona Grassroots Action PAC has delivered that to him. Had they been propping up John McCain and talking about his extremely wonderful record, which we all know doesn't exist, that would be different than coming out and saying that I'm anti-military when my husband's in the military.
But in essence, though, what you're saying about the outside groups funding super PACs is really the case here with this donation that you recently got from this New York hedge fund billionaire. Where's the difference?
The difference is in what the message is. And the message, I mean, I'm not in charge of the super PAC. I have nothing to do with the super PAC. But I think that their message is that we have a competent, qualified, capable person who's ready to do the job in Washington. Whereas the Arizona Grassroots Action PAC has been the wood chipper of politics, designed to attack my character, my integrity, my honor, and my record in ways that are completely untrue in order to maintain the status quo in Washington, D.C., and send 80-year-old John McCain back to Washington to serve us, supposedly, from the age of 80 to 86 on the national and the international stage. People are seeing through it. And you know, I'm glad to have outside support.
What about Donald Trump? Would you accept his support? Would you stand by him at a rally, given some of the things that he may have said over the past few weeks and the fact that he's sinking a bit in the polls? Do you still support what he does?
Oh, I support Donald Trump. We've got to have a President Trump. We cannot have a President Hillary Clinton. We don't know what Donald Trump's going to do because he doesn't have a legislative record. He doesn't have a voting record. But we do know what Hillary Clinton will do. And to me, it will be devastating to our country, opening our borders, destroying the economy, destroying the military, and, of course, destroying the Supreme Court. So I'm proud to stand beside Donald Trump, and I look forward to being a policy partner with him in Washington, because I, for one, am not going to stand for another imperial president like we have under Barack Obama. So no matter who's there, They're going to need policy partners who are putting forth excellent ideas that both sides of the aisle can buy into and get it to his desk so that we can secure the border, that we can make our military stronger, that we can get our economy going again, that the VA can finally be fixed. All of those things are going to take legislative issues, not executive orders like what we're getting from the Democrats right now.
And if you lose, which I know you don't want to think about, but do you just go back to practicing medicine? And, you know, what's next for Kelly Ward if things don't work out?
You know, people ask me all the time, what if you lose? What if I lose? You know, I have an amazing life. I, you know, my faith, my family, my profession are so important to me. And I mean, who wouldn't love being a wife and a mom and a doctor? I mean, those things are more than enough. But I think that I do have some skills and talents and abilities that would be beneficial to the people of Arizona and the people of our country that I could put to work for a short period of time in Washington, because I do believe in term limits. I'm not going to stay there any more than 12 years. And I think John McCain is the poster boy for term limits. So I look forward to, on, you know, August 30th, giving John McCain the best 80th birthday present ever, the gift of retirement, and giving Arizona and our country a chance to put everything back on the right track.
Senator Ward, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks.
And Phil, since she recorded that interview with you yesterday, Ward seemed to suggest that Senator McCain might not survive his next term, telling Politico, quote, "I'm a doctor. The life expectancy of the American male is not 86, it's less."
And if you just heard there, she seemed to imply that in our conversation as well when she was talking about the McCain Super PAC, Arizona Grassroots Action, wanting to send him back to Washington to, quote, serve us supposedly from the age of 80 to 86 on the national and international stage. In response to those political remarks, Steve, McCain basically accused her of ageism and called Ward's remarks, quote, "a dive to the bottom."
KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Phil, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Arizonans are heading to the polls this Tuesday, and at every one of the more than 700 polling places across the county, there will be poll workers setting up at 5:30 in the morning to make sure everyone is able to vote.
But just a few days out, Maricopa County is still looking for almost 400 people to work the polls, and many of them need to be bilingual. The show's Lauren Gilger went to a recent training for poll workers to find out why it's so hard to find people to do this all-important job.
When the polls open on Tuesday morning across Arizona, poll workers will walk outside and make an announcement.
We're now open. The polls are...
Well, hopefully with a little more gusto.
Hear ye is optional, but from the diaphragm, right? Loud. The polls are now open. It is actually required in law that we do that.
Tonya Tunnell is an assistant election official with the Maricopa County Elections Department, and today she's teaching her second class of the day to a room full of soon-to-be poll workers.
So now we're ready to vote voters. We have to know a little about ID. So if you turn to page 32, we can go through that.
It is a challenging position, and, you know, we're not able to compensate them for what they are truly worth. What I tell people is it's paid volunteerism.
This election, the county has to recruit more than 7,000 of those paid volunteers. They make about $120 for their time. They have to find people in the right part of town and with the right party.
In partisan elections like this, we have to have a mixture of the political parties in the polling place.
It's not always easy.
So if there is somebody out in East Mesa that is Democratic, we're looking for you.
But to Tunnell, it's essential.
It requires neighbors to help neighbors to ensure that our democratic process continues forward.
So they look for them everywhere they can think of. Tunnell says she has poll workers who have been working every election for decades. The county has a program for high school students who can come work for the day. They ask voters to check a box when they register to vote to volunteer for the job. They use TV and social media.
We try to be clever. I had a picture of Ryan Gosling that said, you know, hey, voter, you know, it's sexy being a poll worker.
Samantha Pastros is the executive director of the Arizona Advocacy Network, a nonpartisan organization that fights for fair elections.
We need to find a way to get people excited about voting and get people excited about our elections.
They're helping the county find people to staff the polls for Election Day, and they're training students at Arizona State University to volunteer inside the polls and outside as poll observers.
This is the foundation of our democracy, and we must have capable poll workers there to make sure everyone is able to vote.
And this election year, she says the stakes are even higher.
Frankly, you know, the fact that one of the major presidential candidates has said already that they question the integrity of our election system That makes us nervous.
So she wants to make sure everyone feels welcome and safe at the polls.
When I heard they needed Spanish-speaking folks, I said, then I need to go do it.
Argelia Argy Gomez has been involved in the elections process since she was a kid.
My mom was an elected justice of the peace in Superior, Arizona. And since seventh grade, we've been, you know, for 28 years after that, worked her election every year.
She's one of the much-needed bilingual Spanish-speaking poll workers who will staff the election in Maricopa County this year.
Just always had learned from my mother that it's a responsibility to vote. It's a responsibility to volunteer, to serve in elections. And so we've always done it.
According to the Maricopa County Recorder's Office, 380 poll workers are still needed for Tuesday's election. And 263 of those have to be Spanish speakers because the county is required to have bilingual poll workers in areas with large numbers of Hispanic voters.
I think that there's a level of disenfranchisement.
Gomez says she's seen Latino voters feel excluded at the ballot box before, and she wants to make sure that doesn't happen this time around.
We have the ability to really treat our voter with some dignity and some respect, no matter where they come from, no matter what, you know, ethnicity, what color they are.
In Phoenix, Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
A billboard on I-10 at 67th Avenue has a very simple phrase on it: "Hey ISIS, you suck," from hashtag actual Muslims. A similar message has also been seen in Chicago and has been put together by a multimedia group called Sound Vision. Longtime Valley resident Anissa Nadir is a local representative for the billboard campaign. Anissa, "Hey ISIS, you suck" is a pretty raw sentiment. Why do you think it's the right approach?
One of the other hats I wear is that of a diversity trainer. So I'm out there providing information about Muslim Americans and Muslims in Islam all the time. And people are asking, why don't the Muslims speak up about these extreme groups? Why aren't you saying anything? Well, the Muslims are saying anything. The problem is that our neighbors and people in the larger society aren't hearing it because we don't have the media resources or haven't had the media resources to get the message out. And so Sound Vision developed this ISIS Sucks campaign with the billboard to get the message out, to do their part, to say, yes, we've been saying something, and here it is. Mm-hmm.
Is there disagreement about whether this message is a good one in terms of the way it's being said? Just the idea that ISIS sucks.
So I haven't heard any disagreement. The Muslims that have heard it are like, go, wow, we need that message. This is great. I mean, and we're a community of very diverse backgrounds, culturally, professionally, economically. And so far, the message I've heard is this is good. We're glad you're doing it. We're glad you're doing it so that our neighbors will know how we stand on this. We've been trying to get the message to them and tell them, but we haven't been able to get it out far and wide enough. And then also we're glad because we want our kids to know. And that's the language they speak, you know, essentially. That's millennial talk, right? And so we need to get out there and say the message so that they too will know that this is not our way. This is not the way of the Prophet Muhammad. This is not Islam. The message that and the behavior and the horrific acts of ISIS is not ours.
Before 9/11 of 2001, did you believe as a Muslim person that you were basically more able to live your everyday life without any sort of special issue? Obviously, there are certain people who may or may not like that, but did 9/11 shine a spotlight, and then has the ISIS shined a spotlight as well that is uncomfortable, that has forced what you're talking about, this campaign to occur? Because are you resentful at all that you have to have a message like this? Mm.
So pre-9/11, things happened. It didn't really hit as hard and strong until September 11th. Mm. And then with September 11th, we had to get out there in a big way. You have to speak out. And so it's been continuously more and more that we've had to. And so now with all the horrific acts with ISIS and some of the things that have happened here in the U.S., we recognize that so many people don't know us. And yes, do we get tired? Yeah. Mm. Yeah, sometimes. But I have to. I don't have a choice. This is my life here, you know, and I'm an educator.
Right.
And so as an educator, I have to speak out. And as a Muslim American, I have to let my neighbors and my family, I come from a family of Christians who are probably asking tons and tons of questions. So we have to. This is part of what we have to do.
Anissa Nadir is a local representative for the billboard campaign known as ISIS Sucks that you can see in Phoenix near I-10 and 67th Avenue.
In a check of news from KJZZ at 2:38, the Phoenix VA Medical Center is looking for a new director. The Department of Veterans Affairs says Deborah Amder is retiring for personal health reasons. Amder took control of the Phoenix VA this spring. The medical center was at the fore of the national controversy over patient wait times and other care issues.
In Russia, campaigning is underway for elections to parliament, an event which led last time to mass street protests when evidence emerged of widespread fraud. 18 demonstrators were imprisoned after one protest rally ended in violence, but many believe the prosecutions were politically motivated. And as the BBC's Sarah Rainsford reports, it's since become extremely difficult to demonstrate.
Tourists roll up for rides on the Moscow River as a small crowd gathers nearby. They've come to mark the anniversary of a protest here in 2012 that ended in mass arrests. It was one of a whole wave of protests against fraud at the last elections and against President Putin. Just a handful have turned out this time, including a man on his guitar. But there are busloads of riot police.
Is it normal that there's so many police?
I can't understand. If I would be an authority, I wouldn't be afraid at all. I will lead this meeting. I can't understand.
And yet, ever since the protests 4 years ago, the Kremlin has been worried. Its fears increased when street rallies in Ukraine forced that country's president from power. So in Russia, the laws on staging protests were tightened.
There's one woman just on the edge of the protest who's just unfurled a banner. And in fact, the police have just come up to her. I think she's going to be the first person detained today. Yeah, and that's it. She was probably standing for about 3 minutes. Now she's being bundled into the police van.
The crowd shout shame as the police move in. But even a silent picket is illegal now if more than one person takes part. And the fines for violating the tough new rules have soared.
Some peas for Alexei.
I find Anna Gaskarova cooking her husband's favourites, plump curd cheese pancakes and fried dumplings. But she's making all this for a prison visit. Alexei was at the protest in 2012 and he was later sentenced to 3.5 years for rioting. It was May that year and this was the biggest challenge that Vladimir Putin had ever faced. As the crowd arrived at a central Moscow square, they were confronted by riot police. There was a crush and then clashes. 18 protesters were imprisoned in all, and Anna believes that was meant as a warning.
Everyone now is afraid. You can be a man or a woman, you can be 20 years old or 45 years old, but you all can go to jail if you go to the demonstration.
But there is one man in Moscow who's actively trying to get arrested.
So, Roman, tell me what you're going to do.
I'll put on a mask and get my poster, and I'll walk down this street towards Red Square. The mask is of Russia's President Putin.
One new law says that if you break the rules repeatedly, like Roman's doing, you now risk up to 5 years in prison. He wants that law overturned.
I am afraid, like any normal person would be. But the whole point is to show the absurdity of the law. If they send me to prison, it will be for walking around in a Putin mask.
With that, Roman pulls on the rubber face mask. But he only makes it a few steps.
Well, this is perhaps one of the strangest sights I've seen in Russia for a long time. President Putin essentially being detained here, right by Red Square, by the police. Of course, it's Roman beneath the mask. He only managed to stage his protest for about a minute before he was detained. The police say it was an unsanctioned protest, and they're taking him away to the nearby station.
That's the BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow.
Arizona will be getting a new state historic preservation officer in the next couple of weeks. That person sets policy for managing cultural resources and historic preservation in Arizona. Catherine Leonard has worked with the office, known as SHPO, in the past, both as an employee and in the private sector, and she joins me. So, Catherine, I recognize you don't actually start until next month, but are there any specific goals you have in this new job?
Well, I think what we need to do at the State Historic Preservation Office is we need to engage in a conversation about economic development. So I would like the next few decades to be known as, you know, a time when the SHPO is fully engaged with planning for infrastructure projects throughout the state and assisting municipalities, private developers, tribes, other agencies who are grappling with how to develop public lands in Arizona. I think we've done a great job at the SHPO in terms of being available to have that conversation, but I really want to advance it. That's going to be my push.
So do you see historic buildings, historic lands as assets that can be used in the advancement of economic development?
Oh, absolutely. And other states have been leading the charge. Arizona, certainly, we have a very aggressive residential tax reduction program. And we do have a commercial tax reduction program here as well that is lesser known and lesser used. And I'll certainly be advancing that and working with constituents to make them aware of that commercial tax program.
In your mind, is that mostly done through what a number of developers have started doing, especially around the Valley, in that they're doing adaptive reuse projects or taking old buildings and turning them into something new?
It absolutely is. Adaptive reuse is a fabulous tool. A famous urbanist, Jane Jacobs, said, new ideas require old buildings. And all those places, both in the Valley and throughout the state, where people enjoy spending time, you look at one commonality there, and the commonality is historic fabric. People want to go to places that are interesting, places that tell stories, places that really have that multi-layered feel about them. And, you know, people, when they're in those places and they're happy, they also spend money.
Do you think that in general the state does a good job with historic preservation, or maybe a good enough job on historic preservation?
I think we have led the way in terms of being an example for other states on how to manage archaeological resources on public lands. We have rich, rich, rich resources, and not to say that other states don't, but they have really driven the workload for us at the Arizona SHPO, and we've done a very capable job of working with our federal and state partners to preserve those resources. Arizona was one of the first states in the country to have its own State Historic Preservation Act that mirrors the National Historic Preservation Act. We've also led the way with our tax reduction programs for owners of National Register listed buildings in our commercial program. I think we could work on incentivizing private development to use more of those federal tax credits. And I think we could also work on a statewide level to develop our own tax credit that would mirror the federal tax credit and help leverage some of that reinvestment in historic buildings.
Is that something that you plan to advocate for
starting
in January?
Well, it's not the SHPO's job to advocate, but we do have partnerships with advocacy organizations, and I certainly will be at the table when those conversations are had.
So you are somebody who's obviously very passionate about this field. You've been doing it for a while. You clearly care about this.
I love it.
And that comes through.
You'll see me around town. I have a license plate. I'm not going to give it up, but it basically has
historic
my
preservation
job.
Related license
it
plate.
It is. It is.
But do you think that the general public thinks about this, cares about this? Not as much as you do, but do you think that the general public thinks about this enough, cares about this issue enough, pays enough attention to it?
I think they do care about it. They may care about it in a different way than I do because it's my career. It
sure.
Feeds my family. but absolutely, 100%, I think that the places where we live, whether we are in a rural area or we are in an urban area, they shape who we are. History shapes who we are. So I think anytime you're enjoying a cup of coffee outside and looking around you at a historic building, anytime you are hiking around, say northern Arizona and just enjoying the vast preserved land that's out there, you're enjoying the benefits of historic preservation. In my mind, it's the ultimate bipartisan populist topic or of interest for folks here in Arizona. It has something for everyone that everyone can grab onto.
Catherine Leonard is the incoming State Historic Preservation Officer. She'll take over that job on September 6th. Catherine, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Let's talk now about that old line, lights, camera, action. Lighting designer Daniel Davison started off on the action side of things. The Fountain Hills native did some shows in the community theater there, which his aunt ran. But one day he asked to do the lights for Charlotte's Web, and he was hooked. Davison is one of Phoenix New Times 100 creatives, and he joins me. And Daniel, what helped spark your interest in lighting?
There's kind of that control in a way of how lighting can deal with people's emotions, how people can deal with people's feelings. It's a way to focus. You know, you're kind of playing tricks with people. You want them to look somewhere, you put the light over there, and something else can happen away in the dark. So kind of seeing the medium as light, as an art form, was also kind of an eye-opening experience as well. Because I think a lot of people just see lights for a practical purpose and never anything that's, you know, artistic to it or any sort of credibility design-wise. But now we've kind of turned a new realm in lighting design where we actually can literally design, you know, pictures and what color we use and what instruments are being done. So kind of having that platform to jump off on really opened me up to this whole world of tech theater and production and stage lighting. And I just grasped it and I loved it and just took it, you know.
What is the collaboration like? Because I would imagine that for a show, be it a play or a musical or a dance performance or whatever, the director probably has some ideas of what they want the lighting to be. And I'm sure you probably have some ideas of what you think could work. Mm-hmm. So what is that process like to get the final version of what you do going?
Definitely. Yeah, it's definitely theater is a definite collaborative art. We kind of all work off of each other's ideas, each other's, you know, emotions, each other's perspectives. It always starts with the script. You know, as a designer, you get the script, you get the book, you get the story, read what it's about. I mean, our goal is to tell the story just in a different form. So it's a lot of production meetings, coffee meetings, little sidebar table meetings. And then we get to the process of, you know, each designer will do their renderings, their drawings, their specs. So it can be a little stressful because you have all this, you know, all the people who want something from you, but you just got to kind of then put your touch on it. And if something doesn't work, well, then you change it. I mean, lighting is great because we can quickly change something.
Is it your belief that if you are doing your job well, people, like, don't notice that you're there, that it's kind of like an umpire in baseball, that if they're right, doing their job right, the fans don't even know that they're there. They're just watching the game. In your case, if you're doing your job right, people don't recognize, oh, there's somebody working the lights back there. They're just watching the performance.
Right, exactly. We always kind of say the best thing is to go unnoticed in lighting because our job isn't to distract or to detract or to take away or to showcase ourselves. It's to, like I say, bring everything together as one. So some of the, you know, you get critics and you get newspapers and articles and reviews. They don't normally mention the lighting because lighting is also so very, it's something we live with and we deal with every day, but we don't really notice it in a way. We don't notice what it can do or the qualities of it. I mean, even right now, like, you know, shadows and there's texture just looking, you know, across the table, whereas people don't realize that, you know, it's just kind of a thing that was just there.
What are some of the ways that you can use lighting to adjust the feeling of a performance, the emotion, sort of what, how the audience is perceiving what they're seeing on stage?
Sure. One of my most recent, most proud examples would be the show Lady Day that was at Phoenix Theater a few months ago. It was the story of Billie Holiday and her whole life. But I felt like that show really had a lot of those moments where lighting helped to impact the story, helped to create feelings just by doing something as simple as a light change that maybe takes, you know, over a minute and a half to change, but it's a very slow, subtle change where maybe the spotlight's fading out really slow and this, you know, really intense backlight and this little side light is starting to come in. So it's shifting your audience perspective of what you're looking at. I mean, there's one point in the show when she was singing the song Strange Fruit, and there's this really large curdle yell scream at the end, kind of long note that she holds, and I had this like 30-second light cue that just slowly faded the spot out to black, and she was just backlit in this like nice sharp hot searing light. And so the audience gets this whole visual oral picture that then they're left with. So it creates that feeling of, oh wow, what did I just see, rather than, oh cool, she sang a great song, you know, kind of thing.
It must be very gratifying and almost empowering to know that you can adjust the way that people perceive something, the way people see something, the way people feel about something, in many ways without them even noticing that something is changing.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of fun because it's like tricky, you know, it's like mwahahahaha.
Like tending your fingers up in the catwalks, right?
Yep. A prime example is if, you know, you're at a rock concert and, you know, there's some cool band playing and then there's this big like flash of light in the audience screams and yells. It's that energy. I mean, you're creating this, stirring emotion of energy and of feeling, or, you know, you do something simple and subtle and quiet and then it's like, wow, that was... Did that just change? Did that light just change? Did that move? What's going on? Is this something, you know, so you kind of can play with them that way. So I think that's kind of like the tricky, you know, kind of like muhaha way is that I want you to look at this because the light's over here is telling you where to look. When you're over here in the dark, you have no idea what's happening.
Well, Daniel, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Lighting designer Daniel Davison is one of Phoenix New Times 100 creatives and will be checking in with other creatives on future editions of the show.
It's been curtains for a number of theater companies in the Valley over the past few years. An Arizona theater company recently struggled to raise enough funds to avoid canceling its season and undergoing a major restructuring. Fountain Hills Theater seems to be bucking that treacherous trend. The company is celebrating its 30th anniversary with productions this weekend of 30 Years the Show, featuring 30 of its performers singing bits, pieces, and medleys from the more than 100 musicals the troupe has produced. I visited Fountain Hills Theater to discover the secret of the company's survival and success from its managing artistic director, Peter J. Hill, who's been a part of it for 25 years. He started by explaining the nuts and bolts of keeping the company in tune.
The secret is that we're very fiscally responsible. We try to achieve the best we can as far as the artistic level. We go as high as we can conceivably go. But we always keep an eye on the budget. We always have an eye on the bottom line. And it's the reason we do this is it's the reason we still exist. It's the reason why we're one of the few theater companies in the Valley that's in the black. We do this all with a staff of six. The next theater comparable to our size has a staff of 27.
So as a creative person, was it difficult for you at the beginning to want to keep things in budget? Were your eyes bigger than your budget at times? And has that changed?
Once in a while, my eyes have gotten bigger than my budget. Not often, because I've also been a producer where it was my own money I was putting into shows. I learned real fast how to keep closing my wallet. But there have been a few. We did, here we did Miss Saigon, so we had to fly the helicopter. That wasn't cheap. We're about to do Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. We're going to fly the car. Trust me, that wasn't cheap. So
while we're sitting right now, we're looking at the car from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which is going to be your next production. You mentioned Miss Saigon. How in a theater this size were you able to pull this off?
Really, really well. We've just gotten really good at putting the 5 pounds into the 1 pound sack. An engineer from Honeywell, who was part of my board at one point, and I said, I need to make this helicopter fly. And he came up with a cantilever system that lifted it from the side. You couldn't see it at all, but because we have no fly space, we couldn't lift from above. So it was controlled from the side, but no one ever knew.
It's interesting to talk to a creative person who was able to, in the first response, to talk about how we're fiscally responsible, which creative people can be, but they usually don't answer that first. Usually they're thinking first in terms of the creative thing. How have you been able to balance this?
You know, I get to select the seasons out here. I get to do all that. And I get to sit and find out what show I think I want to do, that I think my audience wants to see, and that I can cast. The opener this year, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, nobody else in town has the cojones to do this show. And we're doing it in our tiny little space. And I'm kind of proud of the fact that we're going to pull it off.
So there's the perception of community theater being at a certain level. And does your audience expect you to be as good as any professional theater, or do they sort of let you off the hook sometimes?
Well, we get both. We get an audience who comes in expecting us to be as professional as humanly possible, and we try to meet that standard. We also have an audience that has a little easier yardstick because they realize that not all these people are doing this for a living. A lot of them are your accountant and your doctor, and they just like to do this on the side. So you get a little more forgiving of them on those instances. So, but we do spend a lot of time trying to make it as professional as we possibly can.
Peter, let's talk about this 30th anniversary show. You've put together bits and songs from I want to say, all the musicals you've done over the years?
We discovered after opening night, there was an actor who wasn't in the show but came to see it, and we missed one. We missed one show out of about 130 musicals. We missed Carousel, but we can't fit it in now. But we do. We hit at least one number from the 130 musicals that we've done over our 30 years.
What keeps you going? And are you always thinking to yourself, we need to do better than the last one? Or are you thinking differently than that?
We certainly try to always top ourselves. But as far as having a favorite or anything like that, I get that question actually fairly often, where somebody says, what's your favorite musical? What's your favorite show? And my standard answer is, my favorite one is the next show.
That's Fountain Hills Theater Managing Artistic Director Peter J. Hill. We've been talking about the company's 30th anniversary and their production this weekend of 30 Years, the Show.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.